Today we shall continue with our gradual path of training of a meditator or a disciple, and out of this gradual path of training, yesterday we've briefly touched upon the arising of initial faith, which then leads to right thought, such as thoughts of renunciation, temporary or permanent renunciation, and then yesterday we spoke about virtue, sila, and its definition and significance and so on, benefits. And then we went on to discuss the restraint of the senses, indriya, samvara, sila, which also is a form of virtue, one of the four. And then next comes, and this will be the topic for today, namely mindfulness and clear comprehension. So today we'll first explain briefly about clear comprehension, sampajanya, and then mindfulness. And a meditator possessing this mindfulness and clear comprehension will then go on to select the proper place, a secluded place for the meditation practice, and then will work very hard to overcome the hindrances. And once this has been achieved, then vipassana, insight in its strictest sense, will arise in the form of an understanding of the three universal characteristics of anicca, dukkha, and anatta, and the contemplation of those three engaged in over a longer period of time will eventually lead to liberation, to, in an extended sense, to knowledge, true knowledge, and liberation. So, vijja, vimutti. Now, the relevance part on mindfulness and clear comprehension from our passage on the gradual path of training is as follows. Namely, and this is quoted from Majjhima Nikaya, the 125th discourse, paragraph 20. A meditator is mindful and acts with clear comprehension when going and coming, when looking forward and backward, when bending and stretching his or her limbs, when wearing one's robes and alms bowl. Now, this, of course, concerns the monastics, but for lay meditators this means when wearing one's robes or one's clothes, and then when eating, drinking, chewing and tasting, when discharging excrement and urine, when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep and awakening in the morning, when speaking and keeping silent. So this is one section. And this is the section on the bodily activities, mindfulness and clear comprehension of bodily activities and postures. And then we have another section which deals with selecting a proper place for practice and then actually starting doing the practice. And the text for this is as follows, and again I'm quoting, "Now being equipped with this lofty virtue or morality, equipped with this noble control of the senses, indriya samvara, and filled with this noble mindfulness and clear comprehension, a meditator chooses a secluded dwelling in the forest, at the foot of a tree, on a mountain, in a cleft, in a rock cave, on a burial ground, on a wooded tableland, in the open air, on a heap of straw. Having returned from alms round, After the meal, the meditator seats himself or herself with legs crossed, body erect, with mindfulness fixed before him or her. So this is what the original text says. Now, clear comprehension does represent some difficulties in its interpretation. And when we look at the literature in the English language, then we find all sorts of interpretations that have been offered over the years. Now, for instance, Venerable Jnanaponika, just to give you a brief selection here, defines this clear comprehension sampajanya as right knowledge or wisdom panya based on right attentiveness, mindfulness, sati, which means mindfulness is somewhat or plays a foundational role, and based on this then this clear comprehension arises. And now, I.B. Horner, who translated a number of texts from Pali into English and who was also a president of the Pali Text Society in London, now Oxford, she defines it along the Pali definition of sampajana kari hoti, which means it is acting in a clearly conscious way. And the Venerable Sariputta speaks along the same line when he says that sampajanya means full awareness or clear comprehension through personal experience. One should act, and the second part is important, one should act consciously with full knowledge of what one is doing. So again, sampajanya kari hoti. Now, Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi points out, and Venerable Analaya goes even further to say that this term sampajanya is being used differently in the text. And at one in the Samyutta Nikaya 47, clear comprehension is explained with reference to bodily postures in routine activities of everyday life. And then at a different place in the Samyutta Nikaya, namely 47:35, it's used with reference to the arising and passing away of feelings, of thoughts and perceptions. So this is quite something else. And so, and now we need to find out how to interpret the sampajanya in our context. And speaking with Venerable Analaya, one can say that mostly the interpretation of sampajanya in the text is as fully grasping or comprehending what is taking place. And so one is clearly knows what is happening. And this then is different from awareness itself. Now, the Dhammasangani, which is the first Abhidhamma work, clearly defines or lists the sampajanya as one form of wisdom. And oftentimes it is also said to be an incipient or an initial type of wisdom. And Venerable Analaya points out it has the potential to grow into discriminative wisdom. Now, in our context, Namely, in the context of the second paragraph of observing virtue and then practicing the restraint of the senses and then practicing mindfulness and clear comprehension, then choosing a place and so on. In this context, this clear comprehension can be seen as a mental quality that then precedes the development of mindfulness. So this is a quality that you need before actually applying mindfulness to whatever happens in one's formal sitting meditation. And as for first paragraph, namely mindfulness and clear comprehension with regards to general activities and certain postures, there it's has to do or it's it has to do with the clearly knowing or comprehending the posture that we are going to assume at the time when we are assuming it. And so in the sense of being aware of the purpose and the benefit of it and the suitability of it, whereas awareness or mindfulness has to do with regards the different sensations or different objects as they are occurring while we are seated, while meditation is actually taking place. Now, to give you an example for clear comprehension, and it's easy, in the end it's easier than it may seem at first sight. So let's say you come into the meditation hall and then the question arises where to sit, and then knowing very well that a particular seat has been taken by another meditator, you then decide to sit there. And this may be beneficial to sit there, but it's not necessarily suitable because it's the seat that another meditator has taken earlier on or at the beginning of the retreat. And awareness or mindfulness would then come in when the person is seated in meditation and actually observing the rising and falling movement of the abdomen and other predominant objects. Or, to give you another example, and this has, I'm not speaking from imagination, but what I'll say has really happened in Lumbini. So, a meditator comes into the meditation hall and then graces this lofty place by doing a headstand. And then saying, well, I'm practicing clear comprehension and mindfulness, so doing the headstand while everyone else is sitting is surely beneficial. It will help my blood circulation and whatnot. It might even help me to calm down. The person who is doing it, this might justify this act to himself or herself, saying, well, I haven't done my hatha yoga exercises, and since I'm an ardent follower of hatha yoga, it should be done right now. So the person proceeds to do his headstand in the midst of the seating. Now, from an ordinary or normal point of view, things look somewhat different. It may be beneficial to do a headstand in the meditation hall, but it might not necessarily be suitable, especially not when everyone else is calmly sitting there and calmly, peacefully sitting there and practicing. And so, in this case, proper clear comprehension would be to come into the meditation hall and then to be clearly conscious of what one is going to do next. And then to check whether this is beneficial and suitable or not. And the commentary goes even further to check whether one is within one's domain or territory, and this will be explained later on, and also to be clear with regards to the true nature of what is happening. And so that's the part of clear comprehension. And the mindfulness part is simply to be mindful of the different sensations occurring. Now, this clear comprehension, as the Venerable Sāruppanīṭṭha points out, is incipient, is a form of initial or incipient knowledge that is a form of wisdom, but it does not as yet qualify as true vipassana insight, since it is not yet seeing anicca, dukkha and anatta, the three universal characteristics. Now, the commentators have tried to make sense of this clear comprehension by proposing this fourfold application, namely clear comprehension with regard to the benefits or purpose of an act or deed planned. This in Pali is known as sataka sampajanya. And this means that one checks whether what one is going to do is certainly beneficial or not. What is the purpose of all of this? And then the next step is comes in the form of sapaya sampajanya, which is clear comprehension with regard to the suitability of the act that one is planning to do or just about to undertake. And suitability is in the sense of whether it fits certainly into the general environment or not. Now, to give you an example for the clear comprehension of benefit and then clear comprehension with regard to suitability. No doubt it will be beneficial to give a Dhamma talk. However, if some teacher attempts to do this in a discotheque which is full of people at midnight and people are halfway drunk, then it might be out of place. And it might not be all that suitable. And so, then clear comprehension with regard to the terrain or domain, gochara, sampajanya in the Pali scriptural language, has the following meaning. Namely, is the object that one is observing, and the way one is observing it, is that within the domain of satipatthana or not? So, wandering mind is occurring and one is totally getting lost in the wandering mind. So question to you, would this come under gochara sampajanya, namely clear comprehension of the territory or domain? Is one within one's domain or not?
No,
the answer is no, because one is no longer mindful of the wandering mind. And the other case, the positive case would be wandering mind certainly is occurring, and then immediately one is certainly mindful of it, and one labels it, one observes it, one knows its nature, and thus one is considered to be within the territory or domain of Satipatthana. And the last case is that of asamoha sampajanya, namely an undiluted comprehension of the activity concerned, or we might also say in the words of Bhikkhu Bodhi, discernment of things in their true nature, free from delusion. And it is this asamoha sampajanya that is closest with a somewhat further developed form of wisdom. So the first two forms of clear comprehension, namely as clear comprehension of benefit and suitability, these correspond to prudence or discretion, which are the initial or incipient forms of wisdom. Now, maybe one or two more examples for negative examples for this clear comprehension of benefits and suitability. To be on this retreat is surely beneficial if one practices hard and is diligent. However, if one then decides to I'll change the example. Reading a book is surely beneficial if it's some interesting topic. However, if one does this during an intensive Vipassana or Satipatthana retreat, and then this may not necessarily be suitable. And if an activity is beneficial, yet it's not suitable, then it's best to abstain from it and simply focus on one's meditation practice. Now, there are clear-cut differences between this clear comprehension and mindfulness, the factor that we shall explore next. Now, as we've seen, clear comprehension is a form of wisdom, whereas mindfulness has to do with awareness, being present to the moment or what is happening in the moment. The characteristic of clear comprehension is given as non-confusion, whereas the characteristic of mindfulness is given as non-forgetfulness, as non-superficiality. Apilapana lakana in the Pali scriptural language. And then the function of clear comprehension is given as investigating or to judge, whereas the function of mindfulness is given as not losing the object out of the sight. So non-forgetfulness. And so then the manifestation of clear comprehension is given as scrutiny, whereas the manifestation of mindfulness is either a state of confrontation, being face to face with the object of observation, or is guardianship or protection. So from these two definitions, or from the two definitions of clear comprehension and mindfulness from the Visuddhimagga, you can see already that both of these mental states or qualities work differently, play different roles. Now, let us go on and explore some of the main features of mindfulness. And this is the important part, and in particular important for all of you. Now, as a meditator, we need to have a clear understanding of what is meant by mindfulness, and we need to know its many different aspects and how to apply it to our meditation practice. Now, mindfulness usually in the Mahasi tradition of Vipassana meditation gets interpreted as sati and upatthana, which means establishment of mindfulness. And so establishment of mindfulness, or establishment, is in the sense of approaching and then remaining there. Approaching an object and then remaining with that object. Now, there are different interpretations of the term satipatthana around, such as sati and patthana, which then, according to the commentary to the Majjhima Nikaya, is supposed to mean foundation of mindfulness. And Venerable Analayo, and together with Professor Rice Davis, interpret the term satipatthana again as sati and upatthana, but upatthana more in a sense of presence of mindfulness, presence or attending to the whatever predominant object occurs. Now, the Venerable Sadhu Pandita goes along with the interpretation as sati and upatthana, so as establishment of mindfulness, and then in a further step, based on the commentaries and sub-commentaries, he explains that the term pa to, or in different ways, and we shall later on see how he does this. Now, as mentioned, the characteristic of mindfulness is non-superficiality, or in other words, not wobbling. Not the mindfulness, our awareness should not skim over the surface of the object of observation. And hence, our mindfulness should, as the Visuddhimagga illustrates it, not be like a dried and hollow pumpkin thrown onto some river, but and a dried and hollow pumpkin, what will it do if it's thrown onto a river? It will float away, and it will bob up and down on the surface of the river. Yes, and the mindfulness, or this pumpkin, is a negative example for mindfulness, and a positive illustration is that of a stone or a rock thrown into a river. Now, and you can imagine that certain stone will immediately sink to the bottom of that river, and it will not stay on the surface and float around there. And so likewise, our mindfulness, you know, whenever some predominant object of observation arises, then it should clearly sink into, you know, the object of observation. And when it happens like this, then it will be easy for a meditator in the presence of concentration, you know, to know, you know, the, you know, true nature of that object, such as, you know, the tension, the stiffness and the tightness in the rising movement of the abdomen, and the relaxation and contraction, and maybe some vibrations in the falling movement of the abdomen, and so on and so forth. So that's apilapana lakana in the Pali scriptural language. Now, the function of mindfulness was given earlier on as keeping the object in view, or as certain absence of confusion, non-forgetfulness. Seeing what easily happens in our meditation practice, we are observing a certain object the rising and falling, again the rising and falling, and for a few moments, and since we've observed it already so many times, after a while the mind says, okay, enough of this, let me go on daydreaming. This is much more fascinating. And with this, then we've lost sight of the rising and falling movement of the abdomen. We're no longer keeping it in view. And thus, how can one possibly know the true nature of that primary object? And so the meaning here, the practical meaning of asamosa rasa, the function of mindfulness as non-forgetfulness or keeping the object in view, is not to forget it, not to miss it, and not to let the object of observation disappear from one's field of observation. And the illustration that the Venerable Sāyadaw Pandita likes to use in this certain context is that of a badminton player who keeps the shuttlecock in view. So during a badminton game or match, both of the players have to keep their eyes on the shuttlecock. And if one of the players loses sight of the shuttlecock, then the next time it comes around, he or she might miss to hit it. Now, the manifestation of the first manifestation of mindfulness is given in the Pali scriptural language as visya bimukha bhava pachupatana. Pachupatana is your manifestation. Visya, mukha is the face. Abhimukha is face to face. And then bhava means state or condition. And then visya is the objective field. Or instead of saying objective field, we can also say the field of objects, or simply our object of observation. Hence, this then means mindfulness has the manifestation of being in a state of being face to face with the current object of observation, or the field of observation, the field of objects. And so this then indicates at a state of the mind, the observing mind, being in a state of confrontation with the object of observation. And so the mind should confront the object again and again, and not just observe, figuratively speaking, the object from some big distance, and or from a certain angle, but go or observe the object full on, and only then will the meditation meditator be able to know its qualities. Now, when this is happening, moment after moment, for a longer period of time, a meditator might find that his or her mind is relatively pure. So, pure, freed, or purified of unwholesome mental states. And thus, the secondary manifestation of mindfulness is given as arakpachupatana, namely as a state of or manifestation as guardianship or protection. So in the presence of mindfulness will manifest, if it's present, as the mind being in a state of protection or guardianship. So the mind is protected against the arising of unwholesome mental states. Now, please, this point has tremendous significance for our actual meditation practice. Now, when things are going smoothly and mostly wholesome mental states are arising, then we don't have a problem. However, when at times we are overwhelmed by some strong, unwholesome, or destructive emotions or mental states, this is the point when we need to remember the second manifestation of mindfulness. Now, when we're overwhelmed by destructive mental states, and then oftentimes these suddenly can be quite strong, and then we don't quite know what to do, how to overcome these. And so the way to go is to remember this continuity of one's mindfulness from moment to moment to moment to moment. And so, if we then manage to establish this for maybe a couple of minutes in a row or even longer, then we may find that those destructive mental states gradually will lose their power or their momentum over the mind, and then eventually they disappear. And so this particular aspect here of mindfulness is really helpful to remember, in particular when we have to deal with strong mental states like fear or worry or anxiety and so on. Now, the approximate cause or the nearest cause for the arising of mindfulness is again of a twofold nature, and the first approximate cause is given in Pali as tirasanya padatana, which means the strong perception of the object of observation is the most important cause to bring mindfulness about. And this then means that when we observe when an object occurs, and even though it may be quite mild or quite faint in terms of intensity, yet if the perception of it is clear and strong, then the mindfulness will also be clear and strong. However, if at some other point an object is there and certainly we just perceive it faintly, then you can imagine that if the perception is weak, then the mindfulness also will have nothing solid to work with, no solid datum to work with, and thus mindfulness certainly will also be weak. And Now, the second proximate or nearest cause for the arising of mindfulness lies simply in the four establishments of mindfulness itself, and this refers to the fact that one moment of mindfulness after another over a longer period of time will lead to rather strong and powerful mindfulness. So the Venerable Sadhu Pandita likes to give the following illustration for this, namely, a student who pursues a worldly education, starts with primary schooling, and the knowledge that has been acquired during primary school then serves as a foundation for the knowledge in the secondary school, and the knowledge from the secondary school serves as a foundation for for the acquiring or acquisition of tertiary or knowledge in tertiary education. And the further one goes on, the more one relies on what came first. Now, this much regarding the classical fourfold definition of mindfulness as can be found in the Visuddhimagga, and apart from this, mindfulness should and could assume a number of other qualities. One of them is immediacy. Now, to illustrate this point, please think of some Formula One race, and think of yourself or imagine yourself to be one of those Formula One pilots steering a Formula One racing car that can go at extremely high speeds. Now, if you're participating in a race, and your mind is somewhat, or your mindfulness is somewhat sluggish, then very soon you'll be out of the competition. And so what is required is superb awareness and immediacy in being aware of whatever happens next. And so if some other pilots starts or tries to overtake you, then immediately you need to act on this, and you need to prevent this attempt of overtaking. And likewise, Air Force pilots, jets and plane pilots, usually need to possess a tremendous amount of awareness, and their awareness needs to be not slow, but very quick. And I've once heard that pilots have a decision span of just a few, fraction of a second. So should they do this or that? If they take too much time thinking and deciding, then the plane might, the jet plane might already take a big nosedive and crash. So, likewise in the meditation, our meditation practice. So, please don't see the meditation as an activity of maybe you know, playing cards, just some, you know, leisurely game, but rather something that requires utmost awareness, and in particular immediacy of our mindfulness. So, as soon as an object of observation has arisen, then right away, without any hesitation, without any kind of thinking, should our mindfulness be right with that object. And nothing should come in between the arising of the object and the actual observation of it. Now, if our mindfulness is not fulfilling this particular quality of immediacy, then we won't be aware of what is actually happening in the present moment. And we go on meditating, we realize the objects of the future haven't arisen yet, and so in that sense they are uncertain, and the objects of the past have passed already, and all that we have of them is just a memory, and that's not the same as the actual experience, and in that sense the objects of the past are also uncertain. And so the only certain objects that we have to work with are the objects of the present moment. Now, in the context of mindfulness, we need yet another quality, namely our mindfulness should be concurrent, or to use a somewhat modern expression, in sync with what is happening. So let's say your rising movement is occurring, so it's moving, and then your mindfulness has to go, or has to be in sync, has to be concurrent with the rising movement as it is happening, and it should not be lagging behind in time. If it's lagging behind, then again, how can we possibly know the nature of the object? Now, the Venerable Sayadaw Pandita very much likes to point out that the mindfulness that is required during an intensive Satipatthana retreat is not just some ordinary, some casual type of holiday type of mindfulness, but picnic type of mindfulness, but rather an extraordinary or outstanding type of mindfulness. And as such, it is known in Pali as visita. And so, apart from this, our mindfulness should be intense, and so, then excessive and persistent. Now, the Buddha speaks of controlling five controlling faculties, and those can be grouped into two pairs, namely effort and concentration, and faith and wisdom. And for those two pairs, any kind of excess is no good. But when it comes to mindfulness, the Buddha boldly declares it can never be in excess. And so, thus, don't worry about your mindfulness becoming too intense or excessive. Just keep developing it. And so, The mindfulness of a beginning meditator will be relatively weak in comparison, you know, to the mindfulness of a stream enterer. And again, you know, this mindfulness will be, you know, relatively weak in comparison to, you know, non-returner, an anagami. And an anagami's mindfulness in turn, you know, will be, you know, somewhat, you know, weaker, you know, than, you know, the mindfulness of an arahant. So we've got a long way to go, and with our mindfulness, and we might as well develop it already as best as possible. Now, as indicated already earlier on, the particle pa of the Pali term satipatthana, you know, may assume, according to the commentaries and sub-commentaries, different meanings. And one such meaning is as pakhandana, which means rushing, leaping, and then plunging. Now, rushing, leaping, plunging with regard to what? Well, obviously, the object of observation. So as soon as an object of observation has arisen, the observing mind needs to plunge, or needs to rush, and then leap and plunge into this object the object. And this should be done again, not in a hesitant manner, but with much courage and with much momentum and with force. However, it should be done in a somewhat systematic manner. And when our mindfulness is rushing towards an object, again, there is no time to ask or ponder over questions such as, how come this object has just arisen? What are the karmic forces from the past that have made this pain arise? What did I do? What kind of a misdeed did I do that I have to suffer this pain? So if you're thinking like this, then you're off track. And then your mindfulness is no longer rushing towards the object. And sometimes we tend to analyze what is happening in our meditation practice. And so am I now experiencing anicca, or is this dukkha, or is this anatta? And again, this will take us away from the actual observation. So what we need is just a bare observation of what is really happening. And so any kind of thinking, analyzing, reflecting, and or imagining, fantasizing, and hesitating, and so on, will take us away from the object. Now, the next aspect that, or the next interpretation of the particle pa of the term satipatthana, is in Pali as given as upaganhitwa pavattati, and this translates in English as firmly grasping or seizing the object of observation. Now, see, when some object has occurred, like maybe a pain somewhere in the body, and we're working with it, then we need to firmly grasp it and not let go of it. If we let go of it, if it slips slips away like a slippery eel does when we try to catch it, then how can we know the nature of the object? And so we need to be like those people who seasonal workers who are working in the vineyards, and then are grabbing or seizing a bunch of grapes with one hand, and maybe with the other hand with a knife, holding a knife, they then cut off the branch. And so this then requires a firm seizing of the bunch of grapes. And the same thing goes for our objects of observation, whatever the object may be. And by now, you will know from your own meditation practice that some objects are relatively easy to observe, and also depending on certain conditions of the mind. And at other times, an object may be there, you attempt to observe it, and it slips away. Again, you try to catch it, and again, it certainly slips away. So it is at this point that we need to firmly grasp it. Now, the Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw, when he gave when he developed his meditation instructions, was very systematic and very well aware of a gradual approach the need for a gradual approach to the meditation practice. And so he would request his meditators to first observe those coarse objects such as pains and aches and so on, including the rising and falling. And the rising and falling is certainly coarser than the in and out breathing at the nostrils. And then once a meditator has mastered the observation of some coarser objects, then he or she would be asked to observe somewhat more refined objects, like maybe wandering mind or sleepiness. And once a meditator is doing well with those, then the instruction would be, okay, now observe even more refined objects than wandering mind or sloth and torpor. And there are certain mental states that at the very outset of our meditation practice very much elude us. We don't even know what they are all about. Just to think of equanimity, to most of you, this doesn't say much. Or, what about ignorance itself? Now, are you clearly aware of ignorance? Do you really know what ignorance is in practice, how it manifests? So, these are some mental states that are somewhat difficult or more difficult to observe. Now, another aspect to our aspect of mindfulness and interpretation of the particle file of the term satipatthana is as pavattati, and so this then means an unbroken continuity. Now, unbroken continuity, of course, of our mindfulness. And as mentioned already during the instruction talk on the 7th of July, it's the continuity and the unbroken continuity of our mindfulness that is probably most relevant or important for a good development in our meditation practice. So if our mindfulness is somewhat discontinuous, then our development in the meditation will also be an on and off affair. Sometimes some development is there or some progress is there, and then at other times again things are slowing down or even stagnating. Now, the problem with the discontinuity of the mindfulness is as we discussed earlier on, that during an absent period of absent-mindedness, the unwholesome mental states have a field day, and easily do they arise in the stream of consciousness. The Venerable Sadhu Pandita likes to compare those unwholesome mental states to weeds. When it comes to weeds, there's nothing special you have to do. You don't have to apply fertilizer. You don't have to water them. They'll just grow happily and easily and quickly. But when it comes to some, some beautiful flowers, and then or other plants of your particular choice, then this takes a lot of work. So you need to dig a hole, you need to plant the flower, and then you need to give it some fertilizer, you need to water it regularly, you need to pull weeds around it, and so on and so forth. So planting some gardening flower or garden flower, this requires a lot of work and effort, and this can be compared to the arising of wholesome mental states. So if we want wholesome mental states to arise in our stream of consciousness, we have to work for them. We have to put in pretty good amount of effort. Otherwise, it will simply not happen. And the Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw uses an illustration for the continuity as well as the intensity of our mindfulness by explaining. In the old days, when people, so this is many hundreds or many centuries ago, when people didn't possess gas lighters as they do these days, or matches in order to start a fire, well, back then they had to rub two sticks against each other again and again and again until a certain heat would develop from the friction, and then eventually a spark would ignite, and from this then a fire would develop. Now, if in those old days one were to rub the two pieces of the two sticks against each other for a while, and then to stop and to take a rest, and then after a while to continue rubbing, then it's obvious that no spark will ignite, no fire will form, and the fire of wisdom will not arise. And so likewise with our meditation practice and our mindfulness, a certain degree of intensity and continuity is just necessary for things to move on, for wisdom to ignite. And so the Venerable Sadhu Pandita likes to give another illustration, namely that of house lizards or chameleons. And you may have noticed, well, around here we don't have any of those house lizards, but but maybe at a lower altitude or elevation in Asia, there's no shortage of them. There are those house lizards. So creatures that have four legs, and they share a very particular feature. Namely, when they are moving towards or in a certain direction towards a certain destination, then what do? They move all in one go, all at once. Jackie, you shake your head. Indeed. So what they do is they display very much a stop and go behavior. So all of a sudden, a house lizard can be seen dashing ahead, then for no particular reason stopping, then gazing around, and maybe looking out for a mate, and then at an unpredictable point, all of a sudden again dashing forward for a few for a certain stretch, and then again to stop. Now, house lizards and chameleons apparently can survive or have survived like this. But if meditators with their mindfulness display a similar stop and go behavior, then they might not survive it. And such meditators then might be termed as chameleon yogis. And I assume that none of you come under this category. Now, there are so many things to be said about mindfulness. Now, one of the universal characteristics is that of anatta, which means non-self, and which means that things are not happening according to our wishes, our whims, and fancies. And instead, formations occurring in the body and in the mind are occurring of their own accord. And this is something to be remembered in the context of mindfulness. So when we are observing some predominant object, then we should not try to manipulate it. We should not try to control it. We should not try to make it happen in a certain way or to create a certain experience. Maybe we've heard from some fellow meditator about some outstanding meditation experience, and then we try to make it happen in our meditation practice. And so, all we need to do is simply kind of step back, and with a calm or with a calm and detached attitude, we just observe whatever is going on. Whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, it doesn't matter. Whether we like it or dislike it, it also doesn't matter. Now, when mentioning that mindfulness should have this confrontational aspect, I forgot to point to yet another quality of mindfulness as dynamic. So, our mindfulness, if practiced properly, should certainly possess this dynamic quality and shouldn't be sluggish or lethargic, and therefore, and it should kind of fit the term of observing power rather than just mindfulness. The term mindfulness doesn't necessarily bring across that dynamic quality. And so if mindfulness meditation is done properly, it can be seen as probably one of the most dynamic, if not the most dynamic activity that is around. Now, other qualities that our mindfulness should possess is that when it comes to the controlling faculties and also the pairs with regard to the enlightenment factors, then or groups of three, then mindfulness should perform a balancing quality. So it assures that the respective pair of controlling faculties or of those enlightenment factors is well balanced. None of them is in excess nor lacking. And then when we observe an object of observation, we should do so in a detached and uninvolved manner, neither suppressing an object nor acting out on it. And so we just observe it as it is, and if it then if it gets stronger for a while, then we just observe it that way, and if it eventually passes away, then we just observe that. Now, Venerable Gunaratna, Bhante Gunaratna from the Bhavana Society, recommends in his book Mindfulness in Plain English that our mindfulness should have a non-conceptual quality. So when we observe an object, we don't form a concept about this object, but rather we just observe it for what it is. And this is easily said, but difficult to do. And in particular, at the very beginning of a retreat, meditators frequently see the rising and falling movement of the abdomen in a certain according to certain concepts. Sometimes as the opening and closing of a flower, or as the inflating and deflating of a balloon, and so on. Now, one point that has proven to make a huge difference in a meditator's practice is that of reminding oneself again and again and again about the predominant nature of the object. So you're observing an object, like maybe some numbness, and you're observing it for a moment, and you clearly know it, and then you ask yourself, and now, what is the object like? And then again you repeat, and now, what is it like? What is the quality of it? And now, and now, and now, and now. And so on and so forth, for a longer period of time. For 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour. Now, this is actually quite difficult to do, to maintain this continuity of one's of a sharp mindfulness from moment to moment. Now, if you find that your practice is somewhat weakening, then try to do this, and it will clearly have a galvanizing effect on your practice. It will push your practice enliven your practice. And even though at the very outset of our retreat, during the opening talk, there was much mention of different aims for the Satipatthana practice. Yet, when we actually do the practice, we don't think about the goal or about the aim. We just do the practice. We're just totally focused on or present to the present moment, and so that's all. And the nature of the Satipatthana meditation is that when we put in a fair amount of balanced and steady effort, and we're mindful from moment to moment to moment, and then everything else will unfold by itself. We don't actually need to do that much. We don't need to interfere that much. Now, the one last point for today is that mindfulness serves kind of like an all cure, a cure for everything. And mindfulness serves, when it's present, as a prevention for a prevention against the arising of unwholesome mental states. And should, however, some unwholesome mental states have arisen in the stream of consciousness owing to some lapse in one's practice, then it's the same mindfulness that will serve again as the cure to let go or to abandon those unwholesome mental states. So mindfulness is a prophylactic as well as a curative medicine. Now, one more point, namely, in the course of the meditation practice, our mindfulness assumes different qualities. So at first, like during the first and second insight knowledge, the mindfulness is somewhat of an has an intermittent quality to it. Sometimes it's there and then it's not there. And then in the third insight knowledge, the mindfulness becomes somewhat more panoramic. During the fourth insight knowledge, it's extremely sharp and quick and very much attuned into the present moment. And then in the tenth insight knowledge again, it kind of assumes a panoramic quality. And later on in the next insight knowledge, the knowledge of equanimity about formations, mindfulness becomes more one-pointed, and it stays with one object at a time and not with a multitude of objects at the same time. Now, this then bring us to the end of today's talk, and let me conclude by wishing that may all of you possess the different ingredients mentioned in the gradual path of training of a meditator or a disciple, and in particular may you possess plenty of clear comprehension, sampajanya, and even more mindfulness, and so may your mindfulness possess all the different qualities as outlined during this talk, and thus being well equipped, may your meditation develop more, may much concentration arise, and may wisdom unfold in leaps and bounds, and lead all of you to at least the realization of the path of stream entry, and with this also comes an understanding of the peace of Nibbana. And this is it for today. Now, as announced already last night, if you want, today we can have some questions and hopefully there'll be some answers. So please go ahead. Don't expect me to know everything. My scriptural knowledge is limited.
May I ask a question?
Yes, please.
You said a few minutes ago that your observation of the object should be non-conceptual.
Yes, right.
Then you said you should ask yourself, what is the nature of the object? And that seems to me the two things contradict each other.
No. When you ask what's the nature of the object, then this is not looking for it. You are not looking at the object or knowing the object through a concept, but rather as it actually is happening. So this is not the same thing.
So the identifying as nature comes afterwards?
Yes. In the process of observing an object, we have different mental factors involved. There's at first the labeling, and which is perception, the mental factor of perception. And then there's the actual awareness or mindfulness of the object, which is mindfulness, sati. And we have the knowledge of the object itself, or knowledge of the nature of the object, such as being stiff or hard or tense or this or that. And that last aspect stands for wisdom or knowledge. And so the concept can come in the following way, that we're observing an object, and in the back of our mind we have a certain idea of what this object is all about. Or maybe we've heard, like I mentioned earlier on during the talk, of a certain experience, and so we remember this, and then we see what is actually happening in the light of our of the experience that we've heard about. Then easily the concept might take over, and the concept then seems like the real thing, which of course it's not. And as an approach here, as meditators, it's always good to go beyond the concept, to cut right through the concept, and to go to go deeper, and know what is happening in terms of sensations, in terms of movement, and so on. So with regard to an object visually shown, there are different levels here. There's this certain conceptual level to an object, and then the ultimate level, and we want to go down to the ultimate level.
Could you explain a little more how that would apply to a mental object, such as something that is intrinsically rather conceptual, an image or a thought?
In the case of a thought or an image, And then it's first of all being aware of this, being mindful of it, and then not getting caught up in the image, not identifying with it, and then simply to realize that this is an image or of God, and that there's not much reality to it.
So the nature is just image or thought. That's
yes.
No further than that.
Yes. Right. And not getting caught up in the content of that image.
Thank you.
No, let me add to this. So an image arises, and so it's an image of some scenery, something that we may have seen in the past, and so. Then it's associated with all sorts of memories, no? Memories from the past. And an uninformed meditator would go for the image and in particular the memories. And a well-informed meditator will just will be aware of this image, and and then will not get sidetracked by the memories, and just realize, okay, this is an image and that's all. It's just another object, and then the meditator sees it passing away, and that's it. No. Okay. Any other question? Yes, please. Yona.
Can you describe different physical stages, sometimes naturally occurring, panoramic versus very one-pointed kind of mindfulness? And yet, it seems that in the effort to be mindful, my experience now is that at times it's very focused and at times it's panoramic. And should I do anything? I mean, I'm assuming these things just occur by themselves.
Yes, right.
To do other than if there's a moment of awareness of one thing after the other.
It's okay. Just be a witness to what is happening. So once in a while, just take the mindfulness itself as an object and notice its quality. And so when it's one point, or one point and very focused, then be aware of this and know this. And so when it's more of a panoramic nature, okay, then just know that. No, there's nothing that you need to do. There's no need to change that. No, at least not at this point. Then, yes, Alan.
Yes, you were talking about synchronizing mindfulness with the object.
Yes.
And sometimes it seems to me that by the time the mindfulness arises of the object has changed. Because it takes a little bit of time to be mindful.
Yeah, right.
So I feel like I'm never quite synchronized.
No, what you're saying is quite realistic, and this is indeed what happens for quite a number of days into a meditation retreat. It does take a while for one's mindfulness to really shape up and to be really tuned into the present moment and into what is happening. See, many people assume that our mindfulness per se in a natural state is already quite good. Not at all. It's pretty lousy. So we really need to work at it and again and again sharpen it and make it be tuned into the present moment. And actually it takes a long, it might take quite some time until like in the knowledge of equanimity about formations, which is one of the higher insight knowledges, the mindfulness is so sharp that, let's say, a thought is arising, and one can see the thought, just the beginning of the thought, as it's happening, as it's unfolding. And before the thought unfolds completely, the mindfulness is so strong, that the thought gets kind of smashed away. And so it cannot even unfold. But during our beginning days of a retreat, the mindfulness is so dull that the thinking has every chance to unfold. And it's maybe in a bad case only after maybe a minute or two that we realize, I've been thinking already for quite some time. And so the mindfulness, just like with all the other mental factors, wholesome mental factors, they undergo, or they cover a whole spectrum from very poor quality to high quality. And
even like when you're walking, if you notice the touch, by the time you're mindful of the touch, it's different.
Yes, indeed.
So I guess that's the same.
It's the same thing. And so in this situation, again and again, bring that, try to be even closer with the latest development in your meditation practice. Then, any other questions, comment? Yes, please.
When you talk about the how to balance. Mindfulness takes you, at least at first, seems to take a great deal of effort. And yet at the same time, it seems to me there should be a certain amount of letting go to the process. And sometimes the effort gets in the way of the letting go. In other words, watching the rising and falling of the diaphragm, the mere observation of will change it. So how do you... Like, let's say I'd want to see how do I naturally breathe? But as soon as I begin to observe it, it changes.
Yes, indeed, that's
so. I'm trying to balance this effort with letting go to see things naturally.
So, the way to proceed is that as you're observing the rising and falling movement of the abdomen, and so you have the feeling that you're interfering with it, and then, or it changes the quality of your rising and falling, then just be aware of that. No? The very fact that your rising falling is changing, and for a while it will continue to be like this. At times the rise and fall will kind of happen somewhat more naturally, and at other times the attitude with which you are observing it will also influence your rising and falling, and then you'll just have to be aware of that. So if, for instance, there's a lot of effort being made, or actually over-efforting, so you're overdoing it, well, this will lead to a tensing of the mind, and this will also then manifest in the rising and falling itself, and so as a rather tense rising and falling. And just be aware of it. That's what's happening at that point. And so, on a somewhat... or maybe within 10 days, a period of 10 days, you might get to a point where then the rising and falling is truly happening of its own accord. And at that point, a meditator really feels that he or she is no longer interfering with it, no longer controlling it in subtle ways. So that's that experience lies ahead of you, and for the time being, be patient with whatever is happening.
Thank you. Sounds like there's hope.
There's plenty of hope. And also maybe to add one more thing, you mentioned the rising falling should happen more naturally. This this expression or statement should happen more in a natural way. You know, this is actually an expectation, no? And then what you might do is just take the expectation itself as an object, and then label that accordingly as having a certain expectation regarding the rise and fall, and then be aware of it and know its nature, and then sooner or later that expectation will go. You know, and that then will also make it easier for the rising and falling just to be. Yes, Steve.
A number of times in what you were saying, you talked about seizing grasping strongly.
Oh, grasping, yeah.
Or like the stone penetrating the water, all those sorts of things. And yet there are times when I am aware, let's say, of an itch or a pain, and am trying to stay with that. And as I do, there is on the edge in the background somewhere else another thing trying to arise, beginning to arise, and I don't know whether to make a little more effort to stick with what I'm sticking with, the original pain, the original tickle, or whether to acknowledge that this new tickle is also happening. And I could pay attention to it instead, and I have a difficulty deciding.
So in that kind of a situation, there may be, go by the following rule of thumb. If your mind is well focused on the original tickle, no, and you're noticing all sorts of things about it, and so there's plenty of knowledge there arising, then stay with it. But if you have a hard time observing it and knowing this original tickle in the first place, it's not really working, then, and you're noticing it somewhere else along the edge another tickle or itch, then go ahead and move your attention to that certain second object, and then observe that for a while. No, so sometimes when things, when the mind is well adjusted and well focused on one object, then it's safer, or it's not safer, but it's better for the overall development of one's practice to stay with that object for a longer period of time, rather than changing objects every now and then. And frequently changing objects brings about a certain agitation in the mind, a certain distractedness of the mind, and so there's no need to do this. And theoretically speaking, as a meditator, you could do you could spend an entire sitting just observing one single object, like the rising and falling, or an itch or a pain or whatever else it might be. Okay, it's already past 8 o'clock, 8:15. Maybe this much for tonight, and the next Dhamma talk will be tomorrow.